This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2011 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library and Flinders University Library.
Thank you very much, Steve Evans. Steve lectures at Flinders University in literature and creative writing and is the author of no less than 11 books, including a 30-year history of the Friendly Street Poets. And something I must ask him a bit more about another time is his PhD, which was done on wedding poetry. That's certainly unique, and I'm sure it was particularly interesting. Well, good afternoon to you all. Firstly, I'd like to acknowledge we gather on the traditional lands of the Kaurna people and respect their cultural and spiritual connection to the land. I'd also like to welcome you on behalf of the City of Adelaide as the Lord Mayor of Adelaide to this beautiful town hall and this beautiful room to discuss what absolutely is one of my favourite topics. I was trying to think of some sort of introduction, but honestly, designing cities is not rocket science. It's actually infinitely more complex. It's in Adelaide, at least, a million people who can choose a million different variables on any one day and make decisions based on the world around them and how they interpret and move through this space. It's not just Adelaide, of course. There's going to be 500 cities in the world over a million people within the next 20 years. In fact, just next week I'll be in a city of 23 million, the city of Seoul, that's just been the world design capital. And I'm particularly interested in looking at the sorts of responses they've had to re-engineering their city to be a place for people. Cities are going to have a huge challenge over the next few years. We're now pushing towards 8 billion people, and we'll go beyond 9 billion in my lifetime, with upwards of 70% of people living in cities in the world. There are going to be a huge number of urban challenges in the 21st century, not the least of which is 20,000 people dying of starvation-related illnesses every day, a million people not having access to clean water, and 3 billion people living below the poverty line. This is not just about saying that Adelaide can be better. This is about the world population and how we're going to feed them, house them, give them opportunities, and bring them to a quality of life that a decent basic quality of life that every single human being has a chance to enjoy. I think some of the other specific challenges we're going to have is technology. Transport is something that I've been banging on about considerably lately, but also social issues in emerging global society. Globalisation of cities, but on the other side, the very nature of strong, resilient communities. How do we build authentic communities that can build society from the ground up to make sure that we actually care about each other, we help each other, and we support each other to become livable, productive and sustainable cities in the 21st century. I personally, in closing, would just reinforce that I passionately believe the 21st century will be the century of cities. And in fact, people's image and the image of societies to a certain extent is now moving away from nations and moving towards cities and the character and the communities and the identity of people towards cities. 80% of carbon emissions come from these urban environments, and there's a huge amount we need to do to restructure society to make it fair, equitable, sustainable, and indeed more productive in the 21st century. We've got some very exciting speakers here today, so I will maybe just hopefully put that as a challenge to our speakers today. I will not tell you where the toilets are or give you some details about the speakers, because that's Ben Hewitt's job today. Now, he's got a very impressive CV. It's too long to read. I won't bother. No, I shouldn't do that to Ben. Ben's a good friend of mine. He's the South Australian Government Architect and Executive Director of the Integrated Design Commission in South Australia. In his role, Ben provides strategic advice to government as well as council, Lord Mayors, and advocates for design by working across governments and with industry and academia. He's also the director of 5000 Plus, an integrated design strategy for Inner Adelaide. And please get involved in 5000 Plus. It's a very interesting exercise, and certainly we're paving new ground with the state government in collaboration to plan the future of the inner part of Adelaide. It's a collaborative national pilot project with all three tiers of government working together to have a creation of a design-led vision for Adelaide. Ben is also director of Offshore Studio, an architectural design research practice, and he has previously worked as an architect in large and small practice, as well as the New South Wales government. Prior to his role as the government architect, he was a senior lecturer with the University of Technology, Sydney, and at UTS he researched contemporary design processes, led various design studios, and developed and coordinated the highly regarded architectural practice stream. I was very fortunate to go on the Institute of Urban Studies, Australian Institute of Urban Studies, field trip to North America, to Scandinavia, where Ben and I had the wonderful opportunity of each other's company and walking around cities like Stockholm, Copenhagen, Malmo, Amsterdam, and had some really fruitful discussions about the integrity of design, how design changes cities, transforms cities, and connects people and places. So I'm sure you'll enjoy Ben's emceeing today. We have some wonderful speakers. Please enjoy the town hall. Please enjoy the Festival of Ideas. It's wonderful to see you, and have a lovely day. Thank you very much. Off to you, Ben.
Okay. Welcome, everybody. Thank you for coming. A little bit of housekeeping. First, it's a bit strange, isn't it, the empty chair. A little bit of housekeeping. Mobile phones to silent, please. Please tweet. It's at Ideas Adelaide, and the hashtag is AFOI. So today's speakers are Elizabeth Farrelly, Stefan Lehman, and Bart Lutzman. But first I want to ask, is everyone comfortable? I would hopefully take that as a sign that you're not. Because the festival is about ideas, and I hope that we do get uncomfortable today. I think that we should go away thinking from this, that our conventional wisdoms and our dearly held assumptions are actually challenged by the speakers today and some of the ideas that come up, and that we make that attempt to engage with the complexity of things today, with the wicked problems with which we find ourselves dealing with. Okay, I feel very privileged to actually chair this panel in this space, and I'll start by introducing Bart Lutzma, a historian, a critic, a curator of architecture, design and the fine arts, a member of state and municipal committees in several countries, professor for architectural theory at Leopold Franzens University, Innsbruck, guest professor for architecture, European urbanity and globalisation at the University of Luxembourg, and critic in architecture at the Academy of Applied Arts in Vienna. I might cut these a little bit short because I think Stephen introduced the topic rather well, so we'll get to the next speakers. Next, Dr. Elizabeth Farrelly, trained in architecture and philosophy, practiced in London and Bristol, and holds a PhD in architecture from the University of Sydney, where she is also adjunct associate professor. She holds a number of national and international writing awards, and her books include Three Houses, a monograph on the 2003 Pritzker Prize winner Glenn Murcutt, and Blubberland, which explores the dangers of happiness. Stefan Lehman, our third guest, is a German-born architect and urbanist and professor of sustainable design and director of the ZWSA Research, Zero Waste SA, Research Centre for Sustainable Design and Behaviour at the University of South Australia. Stefan currently holds the UNESCO Chair in Sustainable Urban Development for Asia and the Pacific, and over the last 20 years has won a number of competition awards and prizes in sustainable architecture and published books on architectural and urban design. So, as part of framing the conversation for designing our future cities, I'd first just really like to understand a contemporary understanding of design and reject the old master approach as understood, and the old master is usually male, as understood by architects such as Le Corbusier, and realising projects such as Brasilia in South America, and as sort of evidenced and mythologised in books such as The Fountainhead, and can also be seen, I think, in architects like Norman Foster and Richard Rogers in the work at Barangaroo. So I would like to posit that designing for future cities is not the master architect coming in and presenting a visionary skyscraper in a plaza that completely ignores its context. It's not the transit engineer who designs more roads through cities to deal with congestion. And it's not the planners who decide that the best way of creating, albeit much needed, density is by increasing height limits alone. A contemporary version, or perhaps aspiration, for design in our cities is a group of people working across different disciplines, working together, that understand the interplay of these systems and the connectedness of things. So, and if you like, that's the basis for the Integrated Design Commission. Excuse the little ad there, but where the basis for us is collaboration and open communication, where research is an essential part of guiding decision-making for ourselves and the advice we give back to government, and where people and communities are the central concern for how buildings, places, and cities should work. So that's the designing part of the topic. What's the future cities part? It is now well understood that we have to reduce our ecological footprint, that we can't continue the sprawl of suburbia that eats our farming areas, increases our reliance on the car as the primary mode of transport, etc., etc. How do we deal with growth? The average size of a new Australian home is the largest in the world at 215 square metres, up 10% in a decade and 40% in the last 30 years. And for comparison, the average size of a new American house is 202, 137 for Denmark, and 76 for Britain. Adelaide's population is expected to increase by over 500,000 people by 2037. How do we plan and design for growth? It will not be with design alone. Understanding financing and governance are essential. And can we actually design these too? So the Festival of Ideas and Adelaide over the past few years has heard from a number of people about design in cities. Herbert Girardet on resilient cities rather than sustainable cities, clearly pointing to a future that many other thinkers in residence have also done, a future for our cities, a future way of thinking about our cities. We've heard Jan Girl yesterday talk about cities for people, a focus on the eye level, the restriction of cars. Jeffrey Schumacher yesterday from New York City on smaller projects like the High Line integrating with larger strategic plans to change cities. And there are many, many other people working on cities. So, my first question is to Elizabeth, and what will be the role of cities in the future, and what will be the role of design in shaping them?
This is a small question.
Yeah. It's just a small topic, really, isn't it?
I've just been debating with myself where to sort of start with this stuff. It seems to me that the city is the human species' greatest invention, or perhaps artifact. I'm not sure what the distinction is there, but I think it has elements of both. And when I say invention, I think it's an artifact in the sense that it is sort of designed and certainly made, but it's an invention in the sense that I think the principal purpose of the city as an animal is a sort of survival ship, if you like, for the human species on the face of a planet. And one of the things that intrigues me about cities is that you can see them as a way that we sort of, if you like, roughen the surface of the planet in order to provide habitat for ourselves. In other words, we use nature in order to force her to defend us from her, which is interesting. So it's a sort of collaborative thing, not just with ourselves, but with nature, in the defense of the human species against nature, which we like to think at the same time we're part of. So it has it's a very interesting and ambiguous kind of situation, but it seems to me that it's particularly pertinent for Australia at the moment to look at cities and how we make them, because of this question of how we go forward in the future. And although I think the figure is now 50% worldwide, or was, I think it was 2008, we passed that figure in terms of urbanised humanity. But in Australia, it's much higher than that, something like 80%. Although in that urbanised quotient, of course, we include suburbanised, which is another question. But the role of design in cities is problematic. I was thinking when Steve Jobs died and there was all those eulogies about him, and of course we're eulogising him at the same time as there's all this stuff about how e-trash is jeopardising humanity and blah, blah. But one of the reasons that designers love Steve Jobs, of course, is that he made design sell hugely. He made design into something that was actually marketable and proved that time and time again by making us want a new iPhone every 5 minutes, which becomes the trash problem. But you sort of think, what would it be like if there was a city designed, not necessarily by him, I suppose, but in the same way that made us love the city in the way that we now love our phones and our iPads and our et ceteras. And I think that's the role for designers, design professionals, but also city residents to collectively, in somehow that has yet to be discovered, I think, collectively make cities that we love in the way, and as much as we love our techno devices. Because one of the things that's really noticeable and continues to intrigue me about cities of the modern world and cities made by democratic capitalism, that is that we don't like them. You know, here we are with more wealth and more leisure and more freedom to make decisions and to speak our mind than humans have ever had at any time, and yet we cannot, it seems, make cities that even we like to be in. And I think that's really interesting, because the cities that we admire the most are the ones, broadly speaking, that have been produced by the regimes that we admire the least. You know, Napoleon, for example. But there's any number of them. Most of the fabulously beautiful cities were produced by totalitarianism of one kind or another. And that's interesting. And it relates back to the Al Gore thing about whether democracy can make the decisions that are required to avert climate change. And of course, one of those decisions is going to be about densifying our cities, which we don't want to do. And particularly Australians don't want to do. And the word density is a sort of, you know, we'll talk about green cities and we'll talk about urban agriculture and we'll talk about tri-generation and, you know, all this sort of stuff. But when it comes to density, everybody goes, you know, six packs. You know, red brick walk-ups, no thank you, not happening in my neighbourhood. And politicians, find a politician who will promote density. They don't exist in this country. It can't be discussed. You know, we've just had the Festival of Dangerous Ideas in Sydney, but this is a dangerous idea for this country, and we need to deal with it. And I think that the way to think about it is proximity. Proximity is another word for density, a nicer word maybe. And it stimulates us, it annoys us, it makes us irritated, of course, but it also, cities are green, and I'm on the side of the debate that says the metropolis is the greenest way to live. And there is a debate amongst eco-minded people as to whether it's the metropolis or the sort of Amish village. But I believe strongly that it's the metropolis and that that sharing of resources needs to happen, and that if we can bring ourselves to do that, there will be spin-offs in terms of cultural vitality. And not just that, but also, even if you look at the figures now, in terms of health, happiness, those things actually drop as you go out from the city centre, even in Australia, interestingly, if you look at the graphs. So I would like to see us reinvent, not abandon the city for the future, but reinvent in a way that is thrilling, that is exciting. I was going to put up pictures, which I had yesterday, of, you know, fog farms and, you know, algae towers and all the when you actually put your mind to inventing a city for the future, it can be very exciting. But we need to stop thinking of the city as something that's a sort of regrettable necessity and start thinking of it as a real collective artwork that we live in.
Thanks. So, Bart, I guess it's a similar question, but perhaps more specific. And we know, and maybe this takes it out of an Australian condition into a more contemporary world condition, where there are new cities being planned. And we know that for the most part, new cities are actually planned by different disciplines to designers, by planners, by transit, and infrastructure engineers. That all happens before design even enters into the equation. So are we in fact asking the right question? Is this the right question? Can we even design cities?
Now, obviously we can. It happens in particularly in Asia at the moment, but also partly in Europe. In the Netherlands, there's a tradition of designing cities. So it can be done, but it is only a process that can be started. And on the other hand, at this moment, an increasing part of the world lives in cities that are completely unplanned and that rise spontaneously. So the questions, I would say that there are almost three kinds of cities. Cities that have a history and have already a substance and a society living in them. There are cities that have to and can be planned anew. That is, of course, very depending on, let's say, the politics and also the possibilities of financing that. And that is something that has changed enormously. And then a third, we have cities that come into being somehow spontaneously because of the growth of the population and the people moving towards cities. So those are three very different situations in which also the people that live in those cities have very different expectations, and also situations in which politicians and designers have to work in very different ways. I think when you look at it, that 50% of the world lives in cities and 50% of those lives at this moment in shantytowns, I think that is an increasingly important issue. Let's say if you look still in the 1950s and you look at places like Singapore and Hong Kong, it was still possible to finance enormous collective housing projects. It seems to be possible in China at the moment, but for the largest part of the world, these solutions are cannot be applied anymore. So the question how to design, let's say, to start with these shantytowns, how to design them is a completely different question than the question how you could design them in such a way that you could love them. It's much more about... So that is a very, very different issue. So, in those cities, I suppose it's possible to change things, but you have to be very careful, and you have to more deal with processes and analyze how you can somehow at the bottom do things. Then there are the cities that are planned new, and these cities can draw back on all the theories that have been developed over the last couple of years. And they are realized, the Shenzhens of this world, or the Dubais, they can be done, but then at a certain point it is clear that even with all the knowledge that we have today, at a certain point they have to live by themselves, and they have to be completed by themselves. Now, and then we have the cities that have a history and a historical substance, whether it is a built substance or whether it's also the nature surrounding them, the people living in them and their expectations. And those cities are probably the most difficult to plan. These are usually cities in parts of the world that where you can finance projects, but in these cases, the dealing with the expectations of the people that live in them is the most difficult part, I think. Mm-hmm.
And that leads quite well, I think, into my question for you, Stefan, which and feel free to take up the theme developed so far, but. Given that by 2030, 70% of all our building stock in Australian cities will already exist, what do we mean by future cities here? What does that mean? I think Bart's final identification of city type plays into this.
Sure. I mean, talking about uncertainty, one thing I can say with certainty is that the existing building stock that has to be integrated in any planning will always play a major role in any vision of a new city, of a future city. We have no ability to ignore it further. However, we need better ideas. That's why the Festival of Ideas might be helpful. How we re-engineer and how we retrofit this existing building stock, how we turn it from an energy inefficient to an energy efficient building stock, for instance, and how we retrofit our urban system. So preferable such adaptive reuse is done with contemporary architecture in a contemporary way. And sometimes we can see wonderful, bold examples how, for instance, Jeff Schumacher from New York City showed us the other day, the High Line, an old piece of infrastructure, has been reinvented in a bold, contemporary way. What a success story it is, isn't it? But there is also, and that's where I come in, not just looking at the value of identity and culture, that we have to maintain, which is embodied in our built fabric, but also looking at embodied energy and embedded materials, which play a role when we look at existing building stock. Now, there is a strong link between sustainability and adaptive reuse that hasn't been well understood. And I just spoke 2 days ago at the National Trust about the issue that the heritage group always says, we have to maintain the existing buildings because of their cultural value. And I said, you guys have actually a very strong different argument that you can add to the cultural identity, which is fine, which is the sustainability debate. You know, if you demolish a building, it's highly unsustainable. Not only you create a lot of demolition waste that goes to landfill, but you lose the embodied energy. So I'm not talking just about monuments. I'm talking about a large chunk of the city. And you will know that, you know, every year 1.5% of architecture is added new to the city. And this is where all the media writes about, where all the focus of architects is. And we totally forget about 98.5% overwhelming size that is already there. And I say the most sustainable building that you will ever come across is the one that already exists. It is already there. If you get rid of it, you already lose. Then you have to make all kind of technical tricks to come up with six green star to make up for it. But I don't think that's a good way. And of course, rottening buildings on North Terrace and empty buildings on King William Street are a waste of a resource. And we're gonna have to be smarter about and come up with better ideas how we reactivate our built heritage here in Adelaide. There are so many superb buildings that we do not use. Maybe there is some shop, some 24/7 shop, convenience store in ground floor, and above 8-10 stories empty. Now, why is that? And we had a good debate the other day about that. And I think we have to be much more smarter, better ideas about offering financial mechanisms, incentives to property owners. To comply with the building code is very hard. It's very cost ineffective. So we have to help them. At the same time, there needs to be an agreement signed between the property owner to do certain things in a respectful way to the heritage, but in a very interesting, sustainable, modern way. Come in, do adaptive reuse with an agreement. What will be the rent in future? You want to keep the residents. You want to attract also young companies and startups. So this agreement, we've done this very successfully in Berlin. In fact, in Berlin, we renovated 50,000 units in less than a decade based on a clever way to make it interesting for those property owners. We renovated entire districts in a very short time, and we had to do it in a social way that we kept the residents that lived there for 40, 50 years. We didn't want to make it impossible for them to afford, unaffordable for them later to stay. So what I'm really interested in this regard is adaptive reuse that can be an urban catalyst, an urban regeneration that we have to get into in Adelaide urgently, as a matter of urgency. I mean, we can have a wonderful academic debate between us without any relevance. The other hand, we could also ask for action, come up with an action plan, looking at Stephen Yowit. And what we need is a good urban infill series of demonstration projects that show how great adaptive reuse is, what it means to Adelaide. When we densify, it's not a problem, it's actually positive. People want to move back from the suburb. There is a whole migration back into the city center. We're going to have 3-4 very good demonstration projects now and have action and outcomes and a delivery path out of all the debate about ideas that we can show and say, look how great it is. And people will come then and see this demonstration project and say, I want to have one like that. It's fantastic. I want to live in one building like that, where there is a marriage between the new and the old. And I'm always enthusiastic about combining the new and the old, because I believe it can be better than just the new, and it can be better than just the old. The new and the old, as the city is in constant flux and transformation anyway. There's no end to that. Yeah. So I keep saying to Land Management Corp, for instance, in regard to Bowdoin Urban Village, what a great densification project that is. And I guarantee them the most attractive spaces are going to be the ones that I immediately rented are the ones in the old existing buildings. Mm. You know, they keep from the Clipsal factory, industrial heritage, they keep a series of factories, luckily, and they integrate them well in the master plan. Those ones are going to be picked up, snatched up immediately. Before people go in those new concrete boxes, they want to be in the old, authentic heritage because it's so much better, you know, especially young graphic design companies and so on.
Yeah. And I think that, to me, that points really well to the contemporary understanding of design in terms of cities that doesn't say it's this top-down, autocratic, thou shalt be. It's an approach that tries to deal with the messy complexity of what's occurring across design issues, historical issues, heritage issues, but also how do you make this happen? How do you go about enacting this?
Yeah, and then you see, just to add to that, you see all over the world, people are attracted to historical centers. In London, in Barcelona, in Berlin, in everywhere, in Paris, people love to go and see modern architecture inserted wonderfully in the old historical without overwhelming and overpowering, but respecting the old, being side by side, the modern and the old, having a wonderful relationship. Yeah. And people love that all over the world.
Yep. Okay, you touched briefly on the idea of certainty and uncertainty. And I do want to bring it back to that higher level idea. And Elizabeth, ask you, as an architect, you're an architect as well. I think our training, our experience tells us that teaches us in a way to be comfortable with uncertainty. Mm. And so do you see this as an issue for this field, the way we're talking about the city? Is this something to be embraced, rejected? Mm. How do we approach it?
I think it's a very interesting question, partly because the certainty, uncertainty thing, it's an old question, the uncertainty thing. It's a sort of, you know, the mark of modernism, in theory, you know, the Heisenberg, et cetera, was that the beginning of uncertainty. But the question of design, I mean, architects like to think of themselves as comfortable with uncertainty, but at the same time, they need to make certainty because they're making objects in the end. Planners, on the other hand, who are at least as responsible for making cities as architects.
I would argue more so.
And engineers and project managers, all three of those professions tend to trade in certainties and to rely on certainties. And, planners like to make... and I have to apologise to any planners here before I insult them, but I insult everybody, so, you know, it's kind of fair. planners like to make coloured maps... zoning maps, you know, height maps, da, 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 and they tend to see in that very abstract way. And actually, that's about as pictorial as they get because most plans are really words, just words, and that's what they tend to call a vision. Whereas architects, the single strength and possibly also weakness of architects is they like to make images, and they think in images, they think in three dimensions. And I think if we use it properly, that's a huge strength for the future because that can be the sort of seductive process of persuading people that cities are actually where they want to be. And I like to think, I suppose, that urban design is the marriage of those, that urban design is the profession, which is still fledgling, that can marry, you know, the abstraction of the planners, who like everything to be formulated in rules, and the creativity but object-centeredness of the architects who get too focused on the object, arguably, that bringing those together into a new thing called urban design, which actually is able to prioritize the spaces, not the buildings, but to design the city as connectivities, as connected spatial networks, and to let the buildings come in, sort of design the rules around those spatial networks. Rather than designing the buildings, urban designers need to design the rules that then shape the buildings that sort of fill in so that you make the spaces first and then the rules and then the solid stuff that just shapes those spaces. Mm. That's, I think, the way that cities ought to be made, and it's almost completely the reverse of the way that we actually make them. But I think that would allow us... I think that's actually how we were talking to Philip Adams this morning about Central Park and how Central Park was made. I think that's largely it. There were sort of some basic rules and some basic plots, and Central Park was sacred. And around that, people sort of did what they wanted to, and it filled in gradually over time and made this wonderful room, you know.
I think that might be in part one of my next questions to you, which I'll ask anyway, because I think it could help it. And the question was, history is littered with failed visions. I think it's very clear. And we blame architects for those visions. It's a very easy thing to do. In fact, Jan Gehl did this yesterday as part of setting up the way he works. That he showed the image of, here is the image that architects make, and it's the super real rendering that computer technology allows us. And it has all the trees that are fully grown and all the plants and all the people moving around. And then he shows, here is the reality, which is a deliberately amateur photo of a not quite completed building with the landscape not having grown on a rainy day when there are no people, and sort of as evidence of the vision of architects failing. Yet I would sort of say that's, and here you go, because I want to be a little bit controversial, I think that's actually slightly naive in understanding the way cities actually come about. Because I think we probably all know, if we scratch the surface, that it's in the implementation, how things are financed, how things are governed, what's the leadership involved in this, how is it followed through, how is the vision delivered, if you like. And so I guess, you know, that's you've offered urban design and that method as a way of thinking through cities differently, but are there models perhaps where design, finance, governance come together? Is that a possible solution? Is that too broad a question as well?
That's a very broad question. It would be nice to think that could work. The vision thing, you know, I was used to be on the city council in Sydney for one term, and it was what we used to talk about, the vision thing. You know, someone would, we've got to do the vision thing, and someone would eventually draw something, and the vision thing is still an issue. I think visions, much as they might be hallucinations sometimes, are good and are necessary. We need to envision our future, but we need to be able to do it in a way that's still loose enough to allow for the unforeseeable, clearly. And the best cities, of course, are those that grow, that are not made as objects, but are allowed in some way to grow. What we don't know, I think, as democracies, Western democracies generally, can't seem to grasp how to allow that growth in a way that makes lovely cities and cities that will persuade us by their loveliness to want to be in them. Democracy is a real problem because, and I think it's part of the basic human nature, the reason that democracy is a problem, because when you ask people what they want, what each of us wants as a primate is lots of space and a house with trees outside the window and birds and blah, blah, blah. And that's the sort of, that's the way we vote. We tend to vote on those innate, knee-jerk desires. So democracy is a sort of desire-based system, and capitalism too is a desire-based system. But what's interesting about what we want is that it doesn't give us what we really want. It tends not to give us what we want as individuals, but not what we want as a collective. What we might want, a beautiful city, but what we want as individuals is actually actively destroying and undermining and eating away, white-anting that beautiful city. Every time we make another land release on the city fringes, it's white-anting this city. And the reason these buildings are empty is because everybody, is allowed to go out there. So, I suppose if I were king, I would wall cities. I would say, that not necessarily physically, but there is about an absolute boundary beyond which there is no building. End of story. Out there is wilderness or farmland, but in here is where we live. We do the best thing for nature by staying out of it. And we also do the best thing for the city. And that's, Edward Glaser says the city is the place where the human being shines most brightly. And I believe that's true, that by doing that, by constraining what we desire, in the interest of what we collectively kind of need, the payoff, if we can do that, which at the moment we can't, is, cultural vitality and excitement and the thrill and the active streets and stuff. But so that going into the future is what I'd like to see, as well as, of course, of the environmental, the sustainability payoffs.
And I think that's a fantastic segue to Bart's presentation yesterday. I'm not sure if many of you heard it, but Bart was talking about globalization, individualism, populism in architecture, that literally we've been sold individualism in the 20th century. And one of the sort of unintended outcomes of this is urban sprawl. I mean, maybe that's a chance for you to unpack that a little bit for this topic and audience, you know.
Yes. Well, what is definitely an enormous change over the last decades is that we're not aware, at least. Maybe we do share collective issues, collective problems, risks, but also desires and wants. But somehow we are not collectively aware of them anymore. We are very aware of what we want ourselves. We're trained in shopping. We're trained in selecting our favorite television channels. But we are not very good anymore in coming together and finding collective solutions. And I think this is also something that will not so quickly be solved. It will be a problem also for the politicians, I think. Politicians these days are not so much elected on the presentation of collective problems and promising to work on them, but they're much more elected on dealing with very specific emotional desires of people. And our desires are so powerful, and also the way our desires can be manipulated is so powerful that it overshadows many of these issues. On one hand, I think cities have become so big that they allow for different quarters with different characters and different solutions. That is important. But on the other hand, it is, of course, important to have an idea about some aspects that should count for all of us. Because we should not forget that urbanism, the most important thing about urban planning and urban design, is equality of justice. Not equality, not justice, but equality of justice. If you're allowed to do something here, then someone else can say, okay, if he or she has the right to do this here, I should be entitled to do that too. So that is something which is really important, and it starts with the very basic fact that you can't build your house next to the window of another, because then you block the view and the light. But it's basically that is a very important basis of urbanism. So there are these things we share, these things that have to be organized. And apart from very basic facts like traffic, sustainability, and whatever, I think what is also important is that we try to develop a new shared idea about how we organize these things, how we manage these things, how we govern these things. Because many of our the mechanisms we use are an age old or ages old. And when we react so differently nowadays, and also when we collectively how shall I put it, are so much better informed than our grandfathers or even our fathers and grandfathers were, that also means that we can be involved in a different way. And that is an incredibly important task for the future, how to deal with that and how to organize our democracies in a different way, particularly for planning.
Stefan, another question for you. I think a little bit off the back of adaptive reuse and keeping a heritage, but hopefully not going down that path. And this idea of, if you like, wanting to keep it all, perhaps from that individualism position, are we in fact being counterproductive in our cities? Perhaps a very tangible example of this might be, does our love of heritage promote, in fact, tall buildings? You know, by keeping a very low scale of single-storey buildings, does that mean for a city to gain a critical mass to actually have anything but the mainstream, you have to provide extremely tall buildings to compensate for that?
Interesting thought. I know what where you're getting at. Of course, somewhere all that growth has to go somewhere. All our research gives evidence that the most sustainable building is actually the one between 4 and 7 stories, not high-rise. You know, if you go beyond 25 stories, and I keep telling this to our colleagues in Singapore and in China and so on, it's very interesting to rethink the urban block, and the Dutch have been wonderful in doing that. You know, you've done some wonderful work on the urban block. You see, I believe strongly sustainability is about creativity and innovation, and wonderfully we can design our way out of it. I'm a strong believer that there is an optimistic attitude we have to have towards that. Earlier you asked, who is to blame? Is it the urban designer? I thought that's quite interesting. I always think we should probably, if we blame somebody, we should blame the traffic planner. The traffic planner has, many of them, not all, but many traffic planners have destroyed communities for 50 years. You know, I mean, they cut big roads right through them and split them. And I think, you know, now we have evidence, Ben, that the damage of standing in congestion in Australia alone is $10 billion a year, 1% of the GDP. I think we need to now really make sure we're getting innovative traffic transport ideas in, which integrate public transport and reduce our car dependency. That's really the big way forward, I believe. And of course, you know, we also, not only what I said earlier, looking at right density models, and compactness is a good word to replace broadly density, about the existing city. At the same time, why not thinking about a new city? We haven't had a new city in Australia since Canberra. It's maybe time to think about a new city. Now, today we know a lot about where those cities make much sense. For instance, along the coast, where do we have a lot of wind? Where do we have the right amount of sun that we can run this new city entirely on renewables? How wonderful would that be? And we can invent, as we have so much growth, you know, China is building 200 new cities. We should think about one and think about staging it and say, okay, where should that go that we really can run it, where we have enough water, enough wind, enough sun? And what should then be the urban system be that we would like to implement, and the densities within that new city? I don't think it would be a city that has any high rise, by the way, you know? It is a new city, so it wouldn't have any heritage either. But we better design the city well, because we create now the heritage of tomorrow, of course. So this all those ideas are very interesting, and I'm working with my students now on an idea. Where should we have a new city, and how can we make sure this is a zero carbon or positive energy, city for Australia to adapt the growth, and how big should it be, you know? And how can it grow in an intelligent way without eating up precious landscape and agricultural land? Mm. You alluded to that earlier, you know? It will be a gross boundary city that does not uncontrolled sprawl. You know, I always say in Australia, the urbanization in Australia is quite interesting because we decompacted the city for 60, 70 years. We could do so because we had the car, the automobile allowed us to have all this shopping mall somewhere outside and to have highways and so on. Now, after decompacting and moving outwards, we have to turn that around, say enough is enough, and we have to develop the city towards the inside again and recompact the city. And this is a challenge. It is a paradigm shift, and it will certainly be for the better. The sustainable, the regenerative city, as Herbert Girardet calls it, is the one that is compact, mixed use, probably without high rise, has a gross boundary, understands the importance of a good public space network that makes walking and cycling very pleasant and very safe, and has public transport and green parks integrated in a way that it's pleasant, and it makes us happy. To come back to Elizabeth's point, we are not happy. I know a couple of cities I love, by the way, and they make me happy, but I'm not going to say which ones.
And so before I throw to the audience for a question, get something ready and to come up, I would like to say that perhaps there is a danger in finding somebody to blame. That sort of idea.
I didn't want to.
It's fun. I will admit to that. But I would sort of see architects as culpable, as planners, as traffic planners, as leaders, as politicians, as communities, as citizens. And I think it's that acceptance of a shared responsibility, perhaps for what didn't work, to move on. Perhaps that's slightly esoteric or philosophical about it, but
I absolutely agree, Ben.
I wouldn't want to come away from today blaming any one particular discipline. So are there any questions from the audience? Yes, please. Come to the microphone in the front here.
Yeah, my name is David Benthoven. I like the concept that the title for this talk really should be Redesigning the Cities for the Future, a much more creative concept. Yeah. The last point about this attractive city, I'm continually surprised at the lack of vision, in a way, in front of me. I'm a 62-year-old, just about to be baby boomer, whose children, small in number, live all over the world. The kind of city that you are describing is the kind of city that me and my contemporaries will need to live in the next 20 years. If we don't live in that kind of city, I mean, our healthcare system will be unable to sustain us, will become bankrupt. The future is me and my generation. The question for cities is, how can I be attracted to live in the kind of context and community that you desire? It won't be difficult, because that's where I'll actually want and need to live.
So perhaps less a question and more an observation.
Provocation.
Provocation, yeah.
You invited us to be a bit uncomfortable, so maybe I'll head slightly in that direction. I've been to most of the talks about city design, and there have been several at this festival, and I see all of them dominated by people like you who are into the physical, transport, planning, architecture, and so on. And it seems to me that there's room for other people to be sitting up there who have got a much closer connection with the social. Where are the anthropologists, the sociologists, the psychologists, the people who understand human behaviour and how to meet the needs of human beings? I'd like to see some of them sitting there. You might want to comment.
You probably have to talk to the organisers around that idea when you get invited to a panel. It's...
It's absolutely correct. And apart from all the parties that we have been discussing, I mean, there's also, of course, all of us who produce space, and all of us who may produce space even in ways that we contradict our rationality. So to understand that, I think exactly also the sociologists, the social geographers, and all those people are very important. Until now, I do not see much vision from those people, but they can at least contradict planners and politicians in many ways, and they can verify the visions of planners and politicians in many ways. So yes, that is absolutely important. But the most important today, and I'm not speaking just about the cities that somehow come into existence at the moment, the shanty towns all over the world. But in general, I think all of us have an incredible influence on the city, in the cars we drive, in the almost unnoticeable activities that we carry out. And basically, to exaggerate that, all of us vote with our feet every day. And I think it is. Incredibly important to get an idea about that, these contradictions, and therefore exactly the parties that you mentioned are crucial. They should be researching constantly all these things. In fact, when you look at the modernist city planning as it developed in Europe, and even in parts of the United States, let's say from 1900 to 1970, a large part of these planning departments consisted of social geographers, sociologists, etc., who were doing constant surveys. And somehow since the 1970s, these departments have become smaller and smaller and less influential. Mm. Now, that is in itself, that's understandable. At a certain point, we thought that we knew everything and that we could go on with it. But exactly from the 70s on, of course, there were enormous changes. Energy, but also in our individual behavior. So, I believe very strongly in it that an important part also of politics and of the organization of civil servants is to do this kind of research. So yes, it is a very important point.
I would like to remind you that the first framing of the conversation was the rejection of the single author, the single discipline that we do need to work together.
Making city is always a multidisciplinary process. That's clear. And every, you know, sociologists and so on have a very strong place in that. One of the big topics we face today is behavior change and the increase of consumption and certain types of lifestyle that have an increased consumption outcome. And that's a big topic, and we can only solve those topics when social studies come in very strongly. But I will also like to remind you two other things. Urban governance, very good processes and leadership of the politicians is absolutely essential, otherwise we don't get anywhere. And then to include the economists in that debate. In fact, while we claim we need a new urban model, what we probably might need is a new economic model, as Peter Hett propagates from London, rightly so, because if you look at China, China now has adopted the American model that drives GDP entirely through growth. More consumption creates more GDP is great for China. And we, in fact, in Australia, profitate from that. If China stops to consume and consumption drops down, we would have a serious problem here because of the way we are connected to China. Now, this can't go on forever. In fact, this is highly dangerous, and I think the economist needs to be challenged, the economists, to come up with a new, better economic model that is not driven just by GDP and endless growth, because there are limits of growth. Could talk much more about it.
Herbert's got a question here. We'll have to make this one the last one, but...
Yeah, I think we, above all else, need a new ecological model, not just an economic model. Mm. I mean, when you look, for instance, the location for Adelaide was because it was somewhere near the end of the Murray River and the flow of the river was taken for granted. A couple of years ago, it nearly dried up. Now a desalination plant is being built. So this, I think, is a critical issue, not just in terms of water supply, but also in terms of future food supply to cities, and that is becoming a very, very urgent issue because global urbanization means ecological footprints stretching across the planet in ways that is just extraordinary. For instance, Chinese cities that used to be largely self-sufficient from their nearby hinterland, as meat consumption and other consumption goes up, suddenly China is buying land in Sudan, in Ethiopia, in Brazil, and so on, in order to assure that the urban existence can be assured in terms of future food supply, energy supply being another critical issue. I think certainly when we look at the question of designing cities for the future, unless we have an ecological model, and I would say in this context the concept of regenerative urbanization, that city doesn't just take from nature but gives back to nature, is critically important.
Thank you. So perhaps some last comments from the panel, very brief comments.
Last comment. Well, two things. One is, in response to the person who was talking about sociologists and anthropologists, an interesting model in that regard is what's been happening in Paris in the last two or three years that you might know a little bit about, Le Grand Paris, which invited teams of not just architects but and not just planners, but all poets and philosophers and all kinds of thinkers, economists, to produce plans for Paris, which came up with some wonderful ideas and a remarkable degree of similarity, actually, between a lot of them, which is actually beginning, finally, to show some, to bear some fruit, particularly in the transport thing, which is, again, remarkable because it tried to make it happen here. I can just imagine the chaos. But it was a brilliant idea, and I think it's working very interestingly. And one last comment in terms of the ecological model for cities of the future. It seems to me that's absolutely fundamental, and it's that, above all, that means that the city will continue to function principally as a survival mechanism for the human species, and in turn, it's that that means that the idea that I have coined, that I call for myself the green seduction, should be the driving task for all of the design professions henceforth, in my view, which is to design in ways that are so seductive, so entrancing, that people cannot resist wanting to be in, living in proximity in the middle of these new, you know, relatively dense, green, lean cities that we hope to build in the future.
And Stefan?
Well, maybe just some final word. I think we are in a dangerous state of ecological overshoot at the moment. We have high consumption cities. I think a lot of energy is used for transport and air conditioning and so on. We have to relearn how to make buildings passive design without air conditioning dependency. So it's a big task for everybody involved in that process. And maybe just, you know, as an advocate of urban infill, to come back to that, what I said earlier, and I didn't finish that, some of the biggest gain we could immediately have in terms of sustainability is to build buildings that last longer, are more durable, longevity and durability. For instance, if we would actually produce quality that is adaptable in a way we do the plans and the sections, the height of the building, of the spaces and the plan, the column grid and so on is very important, that we have buildings that can easily be adapted to other different uses as uses changes in 20, 25 years. If we would have as a result of that buildings that last 60 years, 70, instead of 30 years at the moment. At the moment it is accepted that we knock them down after 30 years. What a waste. I mean, this is not a good way to deal with resources. So if we would have longevity, durability, buildings that would last, let's say, 50, 60, 70 years, it is an immediate, easy gain that we could have in terms of sustainability. And then we have to look at the developers, the construction companies also, you know, and the whole financing models and so on. Now, to the gentleman who said this is all boring and it's not radical and there is no vision here.
Could somebody maybe say that?
Maybe just some last comment on that. We do not have to reinvent the city, okay? Maybe a lot of it is careful steps and drawing in the knowledge of the experts. That is a multidisciplinary team. Everybody comes to the table with something to contribute. It is not the radical new, totally different idea of reinventing the city. It sounds maybe boring, but I find for myself it's a very exciting process. Thank you.
Yes, there was the remark about that we need a new economy. That is definitely true. If we think that, again, a large part of the world is built, let's say, illegally, we see now that there is an incredible pressure from organizations like the World Bank, but also in Europe from the European Union, to legalize shantytowns. Now, this legalization has all kinds of reasons, of course. You get a larger control, but of course the main reason is the idea that if you legalize informal settlements, suddenly the houses have owners. If the houses have legal owners, they can apply for a mortgage. And this means that this system of growth and actually building, the building industry is of course one of the most important engines of our economy as a whole. So if we continue with this system, let's say this demand of growth, because the planning of cities is very dependent still on growth. It is very difficult to plan a shrinking city. Even if it is even difficult to organize tearing it down. So we are very depending on growth, and this growth has, of course, a lot to do with the fact that you can speculate on real estate increasing in value. So lately, as I live in Austria these days, we've been studying Vienna after the First World War, where the Viennese came up with a system designed by the philosopher-economist Otto Neurath, in which basically there would be the city planning would be done without money. Also in Vienna, there were many shanty towns. Instead of forbidding them, they let them be. And basically, they improved the system. They analyzed how these houses came into being. Vienna built factories that helped the people to be provided with building materials. And at a certain point, also architects and planners became involved to build these houses. And the interesting idea was that people could obtain a house by working 2,000 hours for the city of Vienna. So, for example, you would work on a street, build a street, and then at a certain point you would get a house. I think these kind of systems, it lasted in Vienna until about 1925. We see similar systems now in Jakarta. I think these systems are incredibly important, not just for the part of the world that consists of informal cities, but also for the rest of the world, because as long as planning is driven by this real estate craziness that we have experienced the excesses of the last 10, 15 years, then this will go on. Mm-hmm. So a new economy, a new economical model is, I think, very important.
Okay. So at that point, I'd like to thank our guests, Elizabeth, Bart, and Stefan. Thank you.
This session from the Adelaide Festival of Ideas 2011 was recorded by Radio Adelaide through the support of the Bar Smith Library, University of Adelaide, the University of South Australia Library, and Flinders University Library.